Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, news from Mars, how silver ions turn your skin blue, injection-free insulin, and using fungi to keep bacteria away. We also investigate a new way to deliver good bacteria to your gut, how a mass spectrometer is providing more effective tumour removal during surgery, and the real risks associated with the infamous bisphenol A.
Those members of the population who had the highest levels of exposure had an increased risk of presenting with cardiovascular disease and diabetes, so more metabolic illnesses. But we didn't see any associations with cancer, with angina, with a range of other health conditions. So it suggested that what we were looking at might be quite specific.
Tamara Galloway explains more later in the programme. Hello, I'm Meera Senthilingam, and also with me for this December 2012 edition of Chemistry World are Philip Broadwit, Laura Howes and Neil Withers.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, the Mars Curiosity rover delivers its first data. Phil?
Yes, Meera. Well, as we all know, the Mars Science Laboratory, or Curiosity as it's known, has been trundling around the surface of Mars for a little while now. And the first lot of data from some of the instruments has come back to Earth.
So what has it been analysing, or what part of Mars, and what's come back really?
Okay, well, this particular piece of data is looking at rocks. There are two instruments on Curiosity that analyse rocks. One is called ChemCam, which is a laser ablation spectroscopy instrument, and the other is called APXS. It's an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer. And they both look at rocks, but they look at them in slightly different ways. The ChemCam has a very fine beam, and it can look at very small areas, whereas APXS, the alpha particle instrument, analyzes over a slightly bigger area, sort of a couple of centimeters rather than a millimeter or two, and gets a more average kind of data.
And are they looking for different things then?
Well, Meera, the two instruments are kind of complementary. Each one's better at looking at slightly different elements that might be in the rocks. But what the scientists have done is fire them both at the same rock. They've named the rock Jake Matchevich after one of the scientists on the mission who's sadly died, to see whether the instruments give the same data back. And they agree very well, which is a good sign that the instruments have survived the trip to Mars very well and are functioning properly.
So it's good that they've agreed, but what kind of insights did it provide, or what were the findings then from the two analyses?
Turns out that there's a slightly higher concentration of alkali elements in the rock than had previously been found in other rock samples. And the composition of the rock is very similar to rocks that on Earth have crystallised from magma that's higher in water. So potentially there was possibly more water on Mars at some point than we thought.
And so, I mean, this is just the first set of data to come back and be looked at. So is it, I guess, just setting quite a good precedent for the future insight?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Curiosity is scheduled to be on Mars for quite a long time and to look at a lot of different rocks. So the fact that the instruments are working is really good, but there's obviously going to be a lot more data to come.
Now, as well as the rocks, though, there's been some insight into some of the gases, in particular methane.
Yes, well, obviously these two instruments are not the only ones on Curiosity. The rover's packed with instrumentation, and one of the other instruments analyses gas in the air or in the atmosphere on Mars. And that's particularly looking for methane, because methane can be both a precursor to and a product of life on the surface of Mars. So if they had found methane, it would be a good indicator that there either was or could be life on Mars. Unfortunately, at the moment, there's very little methane being detected. However, that doesn't mean there isn't any anywhere else. Spectroscopically from Earth, we've seen that there is potentially methane, but it's not spread evenly across the whole surface of the planet. So it may just be that we're not in the right place yet.
Now, moving away from Mars, so they haven't been able to find little green men there, but there are big blue men here on Earth, Neil.
That's right, and it's quite surprising. You might not expect people to turn blue, but there are some people who take colloidal silver suspensions, which they use as health tonics, or because silver has antibacterial properties. So they kind of, the people who take these normally don't believe necessarily in conventional medicine, so they like unusual things, and colloidal silver is certainly quite unusual. And people who take a lot of this end up with their skin turning a kind of bluey-grey, which if you ever see pictures of them on the internet, they do look very, very strange.
So this is a condition known as argyria. What some scientists have now been looking into why this happens.
That's exactly right. So Robert Hurt of Brown University in Rhode Island, he knew that the compounds in the body that turn the skin silver or blue were silver sulfide and silver selenide particles in what they call argyrial deposits. So Hurt and his team look at silver nanoparticles in the environment more generally, and they realise that the body is just another environment. So they looked at the very acidic solution in the stomach and tracked what happened to the silver nanoparticles from there.
What did they find? What causes this?
So it's quite a complicated process, but I'll try and go through it step by step. So the silver nanoparticles in the acidic environment of the stomach turn into silver ions, Ag+, as you might call it, and these are able to get into the bloodstream because they attach to lots of different proteins, because many proteins have thiols and other ligands in them that like to bind to silver. So the silver ions get into the blood like that. Once they're in the blood, they end up in the skin generally. And as you might remember from whatever chemistry you learned about photography, silver ions, when they're exposed to sunlight, can change back to silver metal. So essentially the skin's kind of turning into a photographic plate almost, but on the body. So then you have silver nanoparticles in the skin, and these react with sulfur and selenium, in proteins and the like, and turn into these silver sulfide and silver selenides.
So there's quite a few steps to that process that they've managed to map out here. But what can be done now that they know this?
I'm not sure really, because I think it is a reversible reaction. I think eventually the blue people do fade back to a more normal colour. Of course, that's only if they stop taking the silver suspensions, which a lot of them don't, because they attribute it to how well they feel and they think they feel great. And I think some of them secretly like the notoriety that goes with being blue.
Really?
Yeah, I think one was a candidate for some political office and he got a lot of extra publicity because he was blue. So I don't know if this necessarily will solve the problem of turning blue, because it's pretty easy to fix it by not taking a suspension of silver. But no one's really known until now how actually you turn blue from taking the solution. So they've answered that problem.
Can't say I'd enjoy the attention from being blue, but each to their own. At least the chemistry is now understood. Thank you, Neil. And now to a compound that's received a lot of attention throughout the press in recent years, and for its risks rather than its benefits, bisphenol A. Tamara Galloway from the University of Exeter has been investigating the true extent of this risk.
We're particularly interested in things that interact with hormone systems in the body, and these are called endocrine disruptors. And one of the main compounds that does that is bisphenol A. And it's of interest to us because it's found everywhere. Bisphenol A is used to make a kind of plastic called polycarbonate, which is a very clear, rigid plastic, and it's incredibly useful. And bisphenol A is made from very cheap reagents, things like acetone and phenol, and that makes it quite attractive because it's simple to make. So it forms a monomer to form polycarbonate, and that polycarbonate is used for many, many different things, from CD cases to components of computers. Much of the food packaging that we use today, particularly the kinds of containers that you might reuse, so you might heat things up in the microwave, things like baby's bottles, things like lunch boxes.
And what really, I guess, started off the whole fear, I guess, of, say, the risks associated with this compound?
The fear is that when it was originally synthesised in the 1930s, it was synthesised as a synthetic oestrogen, and it showed a low level of activity in that regard. And it was then put on the shelf because other more potent oestrogens were discovered and synthesised. And it was only pulled off again a few years later when it became apparent that it might be useful in the production of plastics. It's not acutely toxic, so you can perform any number of toxicity tests and it won't cause death. It's not fatal. It's not something that's hugely harmful. But what has become apparent as we've become better at monitoring the concentrations of these chemicals in the environment is firstly that it's everywhere, that you can find it in 95% of people. If you measure the concentrations in their bodies, you'll find bisphenol A. And that's why it's become a public health risk, because of its widespread presence and because it has these estrogenic properties. And so researchers started to explore what effects the concentrations that are found in people might start to have, and they started to throw up all sorts of interesting findings.
So how have you been really looking into this with your work and really studying it to see, I guess, if the risks are really there?
We're particularly interested in the chronic effects of pollutants that you encounter every day. How might they affect you as an adult if you're looking at cumulative exposures? And one of the first studies that we did was to study the database called NHANES. And NHANES is a monitoring program that was set up in America. And what it's done is it's monitored very large numbers of people for repeated years.
So the actual levels, say, of bisphenol A in various populations?
There have now been studies done in populations around the world which have shown that really the vast majority of the population has detectable levels in their blood. So we're talking sort of 90-95% of people. Exposures may not be at a particularly high level, but it's there in everybody.
And was there quite a range, say, in the levels? So you've mentioned that exposure, the levels weren't necessarily high, but was there quite a diversity?
There is quite a diversity of exposure. So we do see that some people have really quite high levels in their bodies. Bisphenol A is one of these compounds that's quite rapidly metabolised, or it seems to be quite rapidly metabolised. There is evidence that there will be fluctuations from day to day depending on what you're eating.
And so how will you really follow on from this then? So, I mean, you've seen this. Is it actually something to worry about, or are the levels low enough that it's not a concern? What will you be looking into next?
I think what we had found was that there was an association between those members of the population who had the highest levels of exposure had an increased risk of presenting with cardiovascular disease. We hypothesised that bisphenol A might be associated with adverse health conditions, but we were not entirely sure what those adverse health conditions might be. So the association was with cardiovascular disease and diabetes, so more metabolic illnesses, but we didn't see any associations with cancer, with angina, with a range of other health conditions. So it suggested that what we were looking at might be quite specific. We subsequently repeated that analysis in a completely separate population of over 1,000 people and found the same association. What we've then done is we've taken a population of people suffering from cardiovascular disease and matched set of controls, and we've looked at samples which were taken up to 10 years before their diagnosis, and we've seen the same effect. So what that is suggesting is that the exposure comes before the disease.
And are there any thoughts as to why, say, it causes these particular, say, conditions?
So we and many, many other groups across the world have been doing laboratory studies to try and answer that very question. At the moment, our best guess is that we are seeing changes in the expression of genes associated with estrogen, but not necessarily just the estrogen receptor, which is one of the main ways in which estrogen works. So the effects seem to be quite subtle.
And I guess so, I mean, now that you've seen, I mean, in a variety of studies, really, this kind of link here, I mean, what should now really be done, I guess? Because there have been certain restrictions put in place. I mean, is this a compound we should be seeing less of and that shouldn't be as ubiquitous, say, as it is?
I think it's difficult. I mean, bisphenol A is used to make polycarbonate. Polycarbonate is a very useful substance. If you're going to remove that from the food chain, you have to know what you're going to replace it with. And, of course, many companies are now working on alternative compounds. I think that we need more research to find out exactly what is happening with this compound. But what we're also seeing is that there do appear to be voluntary reductions in usage, in which many manufacturers are voluntarily removing the use of bisphenol A from their products.
Tamara Galloway from the University of Exeter. Coming up soon, a new way to identify cancerous or diseased tissue in the operating theatre in real time. But before that, a way to ensure that all that good bacteria we consume to benefit our health actually gets where it needs to go. Laura?
We all hear a lot about needing good bacteria in our guts to help healthy digestion. There's a lot of probiotic drinks and yogurts that get sold, very much playing up the health benefits. But what they don't often say is actually our stomach's very good at getting rid of bacteria. Our stomach has a lot of acid in it for digesting proteins and bacteria. So not a lot of that actually gets through to the gut, to the intestines, to where they actually are needed to help in your gut flora for digestion and healthy digestion. And that's one thing if you're a quite healthy individual with good general digestion. But if, say, you've taken antibiotics, which have depleted the gut flora, or if you have irritable bowel syndrome, for example, it can be really important to try and get more bacteria into your gut, into your intestines, to help with digestion and general health and well-being.
So now a group have come up with a way to get around this problem of bacteria dying off in your stomach.
Absolutely. So this is a group from Reading University, and it's a collaboration between material scientists and microbiologists to try and use understood materials to try and protect the bacteria and keep them healthy and safe, passing through the stomach acid and then release them where they actually need to go.
So how is it possible to pass through? They've developed a coating, essentially, to protect them.
Yes, so they've actually using fairly well-known materials, in particular calcium alginate beads, which if you ever look at molecular gastronomy, say Hester Blumenthal, or you watch MasterChef, you often see people making sauces and then dropping it into an alginate solution, which makes these sort of soft beads that then burst in the mouth with a lovely sauce flavour. What these guys are doing is actually making a bacterial solution and then containing that in the calcium alginate gel. And then they're coating that in multiple layers of chitosan, which is a sugar from crustaceans. We talk about it quite a lot at the podcast here. And also alginate. And they do a multiple sort of multi-layer one and then the other, building up until they've got quite a nice, safe environment for the bacteria.
So it's quite a few layers to protect it going through, but then will it also then be able to deliver in the intestine?
So they say three is the magic number. If you've got sort of one layer, and when I say one layer, that's one layer of alginate and then one layer of chitosan, then you get some problems with leaching and before it gets to where it needs to go. If you get too many layers, then there's problems with the sugars taking up water and swelling and breaking. But they say about three layers is three is the magic number. And then it can get into the stomach, pass all the way through and get to the proper intestines where the pH level goes to about 7 or 8. And that's where suddenly the beads are released.
So what would be the next stages really to make this, I guess, a reality and used in, say, probiotics?
Well, obviously, at the moment, well, they haven't actually used this in actual people's stomachs. They've been using wonderful models called things like a stomacher, which is a mechanical machine with a highly acidic environment that does quite a lot of mechanical swooshing around like your stomach does. So they're obviously going to have to test this in actual animal models, I guess, first. But all of these substances are already approved for dietary use. There is also a problem, obviously, between making sure that the size of the particles is good for delivery, but doesn't change the taste or the feel of food. So there's still a bit of work to do, but it's more in the tweaking rather than safety protocols or anything like that.
And, well, from trying to get bacteria into your intestine, but now keeping them away from your surfaces, Neil.
So in hospitals and other environments, you don't want nasty bacteria, the bad sort, to infect you. So one way that you can possibly get rid of the bacteria is by having a surface that released antibacterial agents. So what Vendelin Stark and his colleagues have done is they've made a surface which has got a fungus inside it.
Surfaces made of fungus?
Well, they're not made of fungus, but they have sort of gaps inside them where fungus live. And more importantly, they've got small holes on the surface where small molecules can pass through and get to the fungus. So the idea is nutrients and food can get to the fungus that way. The fungus eats them and produces penicillin-like antibiotics, which can then go out of the holes of the surface and be released and kill the bacteria.
Now, is there a problem, though, perhaps with resistance or things like that when you're, I guess, going to have this generic penicillin on many surfaces?
I guess there's always going to be problems with resistance with any kind of antibiotic. So having this just used more generally, there may or may not be problems. But it's just it's another delivery method rather than a different antibiotic. So I guess it's the same kind of problems, but used in a different way.
And so what kind of stage is it at now? And I mean, is it something that's feasible, really, I guess, to cover, I guess, what, in hospitals, maybe kitchens and so on?
I guess kitchens would be one of the best places to use them because food's being spilt there, so there will be food for the fungus. But I think at the moment, the key is that it might not be as robust as chemical treatments or things that release chemicals through having little pockets of antibacterial things. But the point is that it's renewable. So if you have a little pocket of an antibacterial agent, eventually that will all be leached out. And so after a year, 2 years, however long, it won't be antibacterial anymore. But because the fungus is alive, so long as you feed it, it will produce more of the agent. So that's where the real advance in this one is. One of the things that one of the independent experts who commented on this for us said, he wasn't sure about how long the fungus would actually survive in these things. So there is a question of how stable they are, of how long they'll live. So I guess you'd need to keep an eye on that as well.
So watch this surface. Now, one of the current challenges in the fight against cancer is ensuring that when a tumour is removed, that you also remove the cancerous or precancerous cells surrounding it to reduce the chances of the cancer coming back. And now a new technique is providing this level of insight in real time using the well-known chemical technique of mass spectrometry.
My name is Zoltán Takács. I'm a reader in medical mass spectrometry at Imperial College London. My main area of research is mass spectrometry and the application of mass spectrometry in clinical diagnostics. Our main hypothesis is that different tissues with different diseases have a different chemical composition. And if we manage to get information about this chemical composition, then we have a chance to come up with a diagnosis. And we are also developing methods which can give this chemical information within a fragment of a second. And if we use this kind of methods in clinical diagnostics, then we can eventually develop methods which give immediate diagnosis.
Now, when you say disease tissues, I mean, in particular, you're focusing on cancerous tissues and precancerous tissues and non-cancerous tissues. So how does the chemical composition of these vary?
What we are trying to do is looking at the whole composition, whole chemical composition of the tissue, and looking at changes at the pattern level. Cancer tissue and the surrounding healthy tissue have the same molecule set. So we cannot really define any good specific biomarker for that tumor, especially if it is in the early stage of the disease. But the distribution of these molecules will be markedly different. They are built up of the same kind of bricks, but in one case there is a little bit more of this one and a little bit less of that one, and the other way around in case of the healthy tissue.
So you're looking for this kind of difference in their composition or organisation?
Yes, exactly.
And do you have perhaps an example of, say, a marker or a composition that would differ in, say, a cancerous and healthy tissue?
Biomarker discovery generally focuses on proteins, and in many cases one can find specific tumor-specific proteins, but this is not a universal thing. So in many other cases, you cannot find a good protein biomarker. What we are looking at is a set of phospholipids, membrane lipids, so the building blocks of cellular membranes. And what we found is that the phospholipid composition of cell membranes is quite different for any kind of different tissue, including the diseased tissues. So you can say that whatever can be differentiated using histology, we can differentiate it based on the phospholipid content of tissues.
So using this insight now, you've essentially created surgical equipment, so a surgical knife that has mass spec as part of it to try and see this kind of difference in composition of tissues as a surgeon is cutting into cancerous tissues or tumours.
What we've realized is that electrosurgery in any form, whether it's used for dissection or coagulation, it converts certain chemical constituents of tissues, mostly the membrane lipids, into gas phase ions, so gas phase charged particles. And if we take these gas phase ionic species into a device called mass spectrometer, then we can directly analyze the chemical composition of tissues.
You've shown me a video of this really in action in the operating theatre, and you can see that as a tumour is being removed, there is this kind of smoke being created, and alongside that you can see the mass spectrometry and the various kind of chemicals that are coming off. So this is all really happening in real time to immediately see, I guess, what the composition is of the tissue you're currently cutting.
Yes, the challenge is rather how to convert the spectroscopic information into medical information.
So I guess, yes, how would this work in practice?
The challenge is to compare your real-time unknown spectrum to thousands of authentic spectra. We have a database. Currently, we have close to 100,000 individual entries in this database, so spectra of identified tissues. And we have to compare our real-time spectra in every second to this large database. Giving a feedback to the surgeon is still a problem, giving a feedback without distraction. One way to do it is a visual display, as you have seen on the screen, so we can give a color-coded signal to the surgeon, which can be followed without staring at the screen. But we are actually working on different approaches. We are trying to convert it into a musical sound.
So that they don't have to look away.
Yes, exactly.
Because currently you've got it so that there's kind of a red colour appearing when it is cancerous tissue. And that's with the mass spec kind of going on, the chemicals that are coming off. And then I guess as they start reaching the healthy tissue, it's changing into a green colour to tell them to stop cutting.
Yes, exactly. And we can further refine this. I can imagine a continuous color system which the surgeon can follow.
And so what kind of stage is this all at now?
Yes, the device is being used in operating theatres. But at the moment, the surgeon doesn't have ethical permission to make decision based on our data. So the whole system is learning at the moment.
Is this something that's universal across all types of cancer?
At the moment, we are looking at different tumour environments. We are not only looking at cancer, but looking at chronic inflammatory diseases, inflammatory bowel diseases. We don't really see the limitations of the method yet, but this is surely well beyond the cancer versus healthy, or even beyond the traditional histological differences.
Zoltán Takács from Imperial College London. Now to a potential replacement for a widely used yet dangerous chemical. Phil?
Most people, if they've heard of methyl isocyanate at all, have probably heard about it in the context of the Bhopal disaster in India in 1984, and that's when a large volume of this highly toxic reactive gas leaked from a pesticide plant owned by Union Carbide and killed thousands and thousands of people in the surrounding countryside. It's something that we'd want to avoid in the future, but also, you know, people still need to use this chemical in their synthetic chemistry, and even on a lab scale, it's not really something that you want to be handling. It would be much better if there was a kind of safer, more easily handleable equivalent.
Now, just how widely used is methyl isocyanate?
Since Bhopal and various other incidents, its use in industry is declining, but there are still some processes that you can't really do any other way. And even on a lab scale, there aren't very many good alternatives. There are a couple that have been developed, but they don't give very good yields on the reactions, and they're not very efficient.
So now I guess the search has been on to find some kind of substitute or replacement, which has now hopefully happened?
Well, yes. What Rob Beatty and his team at the University of Toronto have done is make an alternative that's called N-methyl carbamoyl imidazole. So rather than having a nitrogen atom with a double bonded to a carbon, double bonded to an oxygen, which is the isocyanate group, you've got the carbon atom, which has a double bond to oxygen, but it's also then got two nitrogen groups on. One of those nitrogen groups is the methyl bit that you want to attach into your molecule, and the other is an imidazole ring, which is a five-membered ring with two nitrogens in it. And that helps to make the whole thing a crystalline solid. It's very easy to handle. You can make it from carbonyl diimidazole, which is a very easy to get hold of reagent, but it's also reactive enough to give good yields in reactions to make ureas and things like that, which is what isocyanates would be used for.
So it sounds like a good alternative, but there must be some flaws.
Well, yes, it is significantly more expensive than methyl isocyanate would be, despite being significantly safer. So, unfortunately, it's unlikely to overtake methyl isocyanate itself in industrial applications where that is still used. And it's very difficult to compete with a small molecule where every atom of that molecule ends up in your product compared to something like this alternative, which does have some byproducts and would generate a different waste stream. So on an industrial scale, it's unlikely to replace methyl isocyanate. On the other hand, the chemical industry has learned from incidents like the one at Bhopal and developed significant infrastructure to deal with working with methyl isocyanate on that kind of scale.
So really, to deal with this in the future, it's the use of, say, substitutes like this, but also the infrastructure in place to deal with kind of potential accidents in the future and avoid them happening.
Yeah, I mean, this is, Beatty himself has said that this is a little bit more aimed at people working in the lab where they don't have that kind of industrial infrastructure because it's not sensible to set it up for a few small experiments. But you really still don't want to be using methyl isocyanate in the lab. It's very toxic. It's also a sensitizing chemical. So the more you're exposed to it, the more problems you have next time that you're exposed to it. So if there's a way of avoiding it, then that's absolutely what we should be doing.
Now, away from industry and to the human body, really, and a potentially new way to deliver insulin, Laura.
Yeah, so we obviously know that people with type 1 diabetes need to inject insulin to regulate their glucose levels during the day. But no one really wants to be injecting themselves multiple times a day. It's painful. It's just annoying. A lot of people are working on different delivery methods for insulin.
And a group have now come up a way to do it nasally.
Yeah. More importantly, what they've done is not just looked at nasal administering of insulin, because people have been looking at this before, but it's never really worked. One of the problems is with, for example, sprays, is that they're quite liquid. And as you know, the nose is quite good at getting rid of liquid and things like that. So a group led by Hamdan Azhar, who is now at the University of Sunderland in the UK, but was at the University of Portsmouth when she was doing this work, have made a gel. So effectively what they've made is insulin delivering snot for your nose.
So essentially just getting it to really stick up there a bit better.
Yeah, in a really pleasant way. If you think about when you have a cold, the more sort of solid gels tend to stay up your nose a little bit better. So this is a gel that goes up there as a liquid and then gels once it hits physiological temperature. So it's easy to administer, sort of put up there, and then it gels and so sort of sticks there quite happily. At the moment when it gels, it releases about 70% of the insulin. So you get a sort of initial hit and then the rest is released more slowly.
Because I was going to ask just, I guess, how efficient it is at delivering it. So how does this compare, say, to other perhaps approaches being looked at to deliver insulin and just genuine injection, I guess?
They've currently been testing it in rats, and it has been very good at both delivering the insulin in an efficient manner. So most of the insulin that's held in the gel does get delivered. Most, as I said, in that first sort of 8 minute hit while it's gelating, and then the rest over the hours following. And they did show with rats that not only did you get quite good insulin levels, but you got quite good glucose control. So it is actually doing what it needs to be doing. Ideally, what the group would like is for essentially to then be a one day thing. So you'd wake up in the morning, and as you brush your teeth, you put the insulin gunk up your nose, and then you're set for the rest of the day.
Well, it is trivia time now, and it's December, so it's going to be to do with Christmas, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've got to keep it on track. I love the Royal Institution Christmas lectures. I have watched them every year since I was a small child. And this year, the Royal Institution Christmas lectures are being given by a chemist from the University of Cambridge, Pete Weathers. So I thought it'd be good to ask, who do you think gave the first Christmas lecture at the Royal Institution?
So famously Royal Institution associated with Michael Faraday. So I would want to say that, but your face is making me think I don't want to say that.
No, it's very good. So while Michael Faraday actually started the institution of the Royal Institution Christmas lectures, as it were, the first person to actually give one of these lectures was a chemist. He was called John Millington, and he gave the first lecture in 1825. And he ended up in America, the College of William and Mary, as a professor of chemistry. So it was a chemistry lecture, the first one. We're back to chemistry again in 2012. But yes, it wasn't actually Michael Faraday, although he started the concept while he was at the Royal Institution.
And be sure to tune into the Christmas lectures later this month. Now, thank you to the Chemistry World team this month, Philip Broadwith, Laura Howes and Neil Weathers, and our guests Tamara Galloway and Zoltan Takats. I'm Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com. Join us again in the new year for more news from the world of chemistry. But for now, thanks for listening, have a great festive season, and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.